Hello and welcome to Celebrating Cinema. My name is Kiriko and I'm your host for today. Today we're talking with Morgan Knibbe, Dutch documentary and fiction director who has just released The Garden of Earthly Delights. The film follows three characters in Manila in the Philippines. Ginto, a young boy hustling around the streets, his sister Asia, who works as a sex worker for Western men, and a Dutch tourist who travels through the Philippines for his suppressed desire. The film floats in between reality and fantasy while hitting the viewer exactly where it hurts, confronting us with the darkest taboos of our history and humanity. The film, which some consider too controversial, and others the best Dutch film since Spoorloos, is in Dutch cinemas now, hopefully in the future, widely recognized for its bravery and confrontational style, being the exact reflection of the time that we live in, but are afraid to accept. Hi, Morgan.
Hi, Kiriko.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
How are you doing?
I'm good. Searingly hot outside, so this is relieving.
So the first question that we always ask our guests at Celebrating Cinema is what their first memory of cinema is.
Oh, God. My first memory of cinema. I think Fantasia. Like this very eclectic, explosive Disney animation film. I was into Batman a long time, Tim Burton's Batman, and the Ninja Turtles. Yeah.
And those were, I don't know, maybe those were the films that inspired you to then pursue a career in cinema, but maybe there is somewhere later, a few years later, a film that that stuck with you, that made you decide that this is what you loved.
Yeah, I got into horror a lot and gore for a long time.
Oh, horrible.
Like Cannibal Holocaust and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, stuff like that. Oh, now everyone's going to say that I am into like like misery and exploitation. I remember like this very specifically, this moment when my mom and I went to rent a video cassette or was it a DVD? It was probably a DVD. Yeah. Mm. We went to the DVD rental store because you still had to rent that stuff. Instead of getting Batman again, I think I was 13 or something, my mom got Dancer in the Dark. She wanted to see Dancer in the Dark.
Wow.
Because she liked Björk and she was curious about it. So we sat through this movie and I was really irritated and frustrated because I didn't like the film. And I thought it was traumatizing and stuff.
You already thought at 13 that something was traumatizing you?
Well, maybe I didn't really think that, but I was just really, I was wondering why I had to watch something awful like that.
Mm-hmm.
But a couple of years later, I think, I was maybe 15 or 16. I saw it again on television and it suddenly hit. And I watched the whole thing again and I was like in tears. I never had a film that was so deeply impressing. I never saw a film that made so much impression on me before. And then I got into film and I started watching a lot of stuff, especially Chris Cunningham. He's more like a music video director. Who did music videos for Aphex Twin.
Ah, right.
That was really inspiring to me. And I got into stop motion, like Jan Zwankmajer. There's this old tradition of Czech animation, very surreal and dark. That was very inspiring to me. So for a long time, I wanted to do animation. And then I got into special makeup, like masks and stuff. And I was drawing a lot and painting and drumming, making a lot of music. I wanted to go to conservatory, but then at some point I realized that film kind of combined all those things, also photography, music. I bought a cheap camera, DV camera, and I started filming people in my neighborhood and realized that the camera was an excuse to just enter people's lives and ask them anything. So that's kind of how I got into making documentaries. First,
what you're saying about how Dancer in the Dark didn't hit you the first time you saw it, But then you only got to understand the darkness of it later is, I think, in some way telling for a lot of things that you've made so far, or at least I think in your documentaries, but also in the garden, you have a tendency to find the darkest corners of the earth.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's...
No, that's true.
Why is that?
Why am I so fascinated with the darkest corners of the earth? Yeah, I'm not sure if I have a very clear answer to that, but I do think that it's important for us to confront our dark side instead of looking away. And there's a lot of dark stuff happening in the world that we tend to look away from. So,
one thing that I recognize from what you just said about how the first time when you see something, it doesn't hit, but then something hits later. I think that is a feeling that I recognize from watching certain films, but it's a very rare thing in cinema because it's often, I think, made in a way to hit you immediately on the spot, to give you the feeling that you're experiencing pain together, rather than, let's say, leaving you with question marks after you leave the cinema. Is that something that, I think it's something I see in your films as well, but I don't know if that's the mystery is something that you choose, or maybe I'm curious to know how you make those decisions to leave mystery there.
It's not my intention to make work that people don't immediately understand. It's not like an intention, but apparently that's sometimes the effect of it. I think my primary goal is to hit people emotionally and to make them feel things and see perspectives that maybe they didn't understand yet or that they haven't considered yet. I think film can act as a sort of empathy machine that allows you to understand perspectives of people that are, well, other people that are not you.
So what you were just saying about how film can be used as a empathy machine.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know if how this empathy is revoked in a different way now that you're creating fiction rather than documentary. So if the effect is different.
I haven't really thought about it like that before. I think with each subject, I try to create a cinematic form that I think works best for the theme and the subject. And sometimes that's documentary, sometimes that's fiction. And very often it becomes sort of hybrid for me because I would like the work to be close to reality, even though it's a perspective, you know, it's a subjective experience that I share. It's often like a reflection on things that really happen in our world. But yeah, for those who feel the fire burning, for example, I felt like I really wanted to document the real lives of refugees. And with the Garden of Earthly Delights, it was a bit complicated to... the film shows things that a lot of people don't want to share or don't want to... They don't want to expose themselves like that. It's full of taboo subjects. So it's very hard to find people who would want to expose that kind of stuff about themselves. I don't know if you know, but before I did The Garden of Earthly Delights, I did camera work for a documentary about the lives of street kids in the slums of Manila.
Mm-hmm.
For a different director. Her name's Mikaela Kho. She's a Danish director, and she wanted to make a documentary about these kids from the slums of Manila who were taken out of the slums by an NGO who offered them rehab for a year, therapy and schooling. So we followed their process, and that was basically research for The Garden of Earthly Delights.
Yeah, I sort of automatically started comparing Those Who Feel the Fire Burning and and the garden in how they both relate to fiction and documentary. And I almost even thought maybe in some places, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning feels more fiction than documentary because of the perspective you chose, because it's a film that is, you chose the perspective of a ghost. And then in The Garden, you feel that it's so close to the lives that the actors actually live. But then maybe, but I don't know if you agree with this, Those Who Feel the Fire Burning was so celebrated for the documentary qualities that it had. And then I feel like it's the way The Garden is received is more complicated for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm wondering if it would have been the same way if you presented it as a documentary.
Maybe, yes. I think people in general see fiction films more as a form of entertainment. And I don't really see it as such. I mean, of course, also a form of entertainment. But for me personally, it's first and foremost a form of activism, especially when it comes to these kinds of subjects. I make these works out of a sense of solidarity and compassion and an urge to ask audiences to feel respect and compassion for perspectives that they haven't considered yet or that they purposefully look away from. But I think most audiences go and see a fiction movie to relax or to have some, even if it's an art house film, then maybe it's like food for thought, but to be confronted with big world issues in very confronting ways, I don't think that many people see the medium as such necessarily.
And is that something you now discovered because of the process, how this film went? Or is this something you ever expected?
Well, I expected there to be a discussion. I always knew that people would find it or some of the things portrayed in the film controversial. But I thought the film festivals would understand it and back it. But it seems like at the film festivals, they were already concerned about me being a white man telling this story. And I think also a little bit afraid of potential backlash. The film tackles so many controversial themes and things that are very sensitive in our current day society, and understandably so. I think there's also a bit of a culture of fear around these topics right now, and complicated discourse around who's allowed to tell which stories or not.
I saw in your thank you credits that you named a few directors who I think have in different ways chose same paths of bravery in, I would say, taking responsibility for, some form of telling painful history, like Renzo Martens and Guido Hendricks maybe also.
Well, the film is very self-critical in a way, just like maybe Enjoy Poverty by Renzo Martens, which was a big inspiration for me at the time, and which was also heavily criticized because people thought that he was being too vain, while actually he was playing a vain character to hold up a mirror to audiences. And the character of Michael in The Garden of Earthly Delights is also kind of a mirror for the audience, which might be a bit hard to understand for some people because, of course, he's someone who feels attracted to children and also acts upon that at some point. But his privilege, that's what the film reflects on. Mm-hmm. And the system of inequality that facilitates his behavior and that makes it very easy for him to cross the line in the shadows of our global economy, which are built on a post-colonial system. And the audience is not really allowed to point their finger at this person as the single source of evil because he's humanized. And some people find that very difficult, but he's also human and he's layered. He's sensitive and vulnerable and clumsy and very lonely. But what he does, the crime he commits, is ultimately facilitated by a system that we are collectively responsible for. And that's pretty much the main point of the film.
Yeah.
So that must be confronting for some people.
Yeah. And I can imagine also frustrating if your look on the world is you are blamed for being the mirror in some way. Mm. Or at least I find it very telling for the time that we live in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think people like to create binaries of good and evil. And also in film, I think, and in our storytelling, we are used to seeing characters as, often as good characters and evil characters. And to have like such a controversial character also be portrayed with humanity, that I think that's confusing for some people.
Mm. Maybe to go back to the film, what you're saying about this need for a binary, I think is something that is maybe also very Eurocentral. And one thing that I really liked in your film, there is a part where in a dialogue it is explained how gender fluidity is also a form of living that was destroyed by colonialism. And I think it's, in also in one way, how your film is made and the topics it touches upon, it leaves a lot of things in the air, or it leaves space for magic and thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious to know why also the topic of gender fluidity or of gender was important for you to include in this film.
Well, obviously the film is about the sex industry in the Philippines and how that is also a continuation of colonial power dynamics. And I found it very important to show Christianity, which is omnipresent in the Philippines, was used as a way to oppress people and to violently indoctrinate a binary gender system and to erase a gender diverse culture. So in the Philippines, before the Spanish arrived, there was a culture of gender diversity, and gender fluidity was often celebrated, even seen as divine, two-spiritedness. And I think that is something that is still present in the culture in the Philippines. You see the same pattern, actually, in many formerly colonized places. Mm. I always say that they were already woke before the West finally woke up. And you can feel that the colonizers haven't really succeeded in completely destroying and erasing that culture. It's still there. Sometimes people think that, like, the trans people that you see a lot in Manila and the Philippines is merely a result of, like, people trying to survive within the sex industry so that they do it for economic reasons. But I think it's much deeper than that. I did a lot of research on what it must have been like before the Spaniards arrived. And that was very important for me to work into the film and to show that sexuality is also oppressed, and that continues to this day. Something that's actually supposed to be beautiful and something that hits at the core of the identity of our main characters is exploited to this day by a capitalist system.
And you use magic and psychedelics also, I think, as a way to carry this history, or at least it feels as if the pre-colonial Philippines is shown through this route. I'd like to know why you chose magic to show this history.
I found it important to show, despite all the misery that you see and all the suffering that you see in the film, and all the hardship and the poverty, to show the internal world of this child who, despite everything, is resilient in the face of oppression, and who still celebrates life and makes the best of it, despite growing up in extreme circumstances. And of course, the main character is addicted to crystal meth, so this allowed for a cinematic language to explore a subconscious realm and to convey ideas beyond just like the documentary reality, which is also, of course, very important.
And is this sense of magic and also of fantasy something that you saw there, like during your research, or is it something that you saw in the reality of life?
Well, I did a lot of interviews during research, and also, of course, during the making of this documentary, A Year of Hope, when we followed the rehabilitation of a group of street kids for a year. The stories that the children told us sometimes had like these elements of magical realism as well. Like in the drawings that they did during therapy, and in the ways that they would describe what it's like to trip on glue and crystal meth. So that was quite early on something that I found interesting to incorporate into the film, the cinematic experience.
I was thinking a lot about how this film was produced as I was watching it, because it felt in so many ways a film that was very difficult to direct, because you also use so many documentary elements in your film. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to know if directing humans in documentaries or humans in fiction was very different for you, and how it was different for you.
Also, for those with a fire burning, I worked myself into a situation which is ethically complicated, because I work with marginalized people, and it's very important to be aware of your potential blind spots and to be super respectful, because you don't want to continue the exploitation that you're trying to critique with the film, and to reinforce problematic power dynamics. But, however, it was still, in a way, easier that once this trust, this basis of trust had been established with the people that I wanted to film for Those Who Feel the Fire Burning, to just start filming, because they would just, like, reenact their their real lives, like the stuff that they would do on a daily basis.
Yeah.
But with The Garden, it was, of course, much more complicated, because we were working with children, with non-actors, in slum areas where a real war on drugs is raging. And, of course, I mean, we worked with a huge crew, so very complicated scenes. Things had to be rehearsed for months during shooting. Yeah, we worked with an average, I think, of 80 people on set per day. Yeah, it was much more complicated than asking them to just reenact their everyday lives.
Yeah.
Also, working with the kids, we're also always guided by intimacy coordinators and local therapists, by the way.
I also thought, but I'm not sure if this is something you agree with, that the film is in some way has a Dutch character to it, and not in a way that it's, I think Dutch films are generally known to be very bad. So that's not what I'm trying to say. But I think not all Dutch directors, but some Dutch directors are characterized for being very bold and explicit. And I think you played with a sense of being explicit in a very beautiful and, I think, very clever way.
I never really think about it like that. But in terms of the explicit elements, for me it was very important to show, especially for the adult characters, of course, because we didn't show any explicit things with the child actors.
Mm.
But with the adult characters, I found it very important to show what these people have to go through on a daily basis and that not to hide that from you. So the character of Asia, for example, she tries to save up money to look for a better life and move to Denmark to become a cleaner there. And in order to do so, she has to sleep with a lot of customers every day. And the reality of that, I really wanted to show. And the impulse of not showing things like that, I think, also touches on a legacy of Puritanism, which is exactly what we also wanted to critique in the film. Again, the Christian religion, which was used to oppress sexuality and to indoctrinate a binary gender system. Our tendency to look away from sexual images, especially when they're presented in a public context. I think the shame around that also has to do something with our religious history. And I think that filmmakers should have the space to reflect on human sexuality and sex in a creative way without it immediately being categorized as pornography. But it was extra difficult with this specific scene that I'm referring to because the very scene is a reflection on the objectification of this character who's called Asia. So you see the scene through the perspective of these white men who are creating a porno, but then that is deconstructed when she negotiates for more money and you start seeing things from her perspective.
Yeah, you need to show also the images that people recognize themselves, not from porn and objectification, to sort of understand what their intention is, of course. Yeah. So then to do that first, you see how we see Asian women, I guess.
Yeah, it shows how they look at
her. Exactly.
Not how I look at her.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that is something that confuses audiences sometimes. And that's something that I see a lot now also in how people talk about film and about problematic characters in film. They tend to confuse the problematic behavior of the characters in the film with the director's opinion or ideas. But of course, it's not synonymous. It's a way to make things that are actually happening in this world discussable and to allow people to look at it and to think about it.
To reflect upon the time that we live in and also the climate of cinema that we live in, how do you see the future of telling stories, specifically in regards of this climate where I think a lot of people believe that you are one with what you tell, or at least...
Yeah, you mean in terms of who's allowed to tell which stories?
Yeah, you did something that a lot of people are, or actually the world is afraid to say because it hasn't been said. But then you're also by some criticized for it.
Yeah. Well, the way I see it is I want to contribute something to decolonization and I happen to be white and privileged. So I understand that I may have potential blind spots, but that doesn't mean that I should be passive. It means that I should be very proactive and work on my blind spots and keep engaging in discussion. But I find it very important to use my privilege to contribute to deconstructing modern capitalism, which is built on colonialism. And if this discourse around identity politics and about who's allowed to tell which stories leads to a sort of numbing where I should just like sit on the sideline and wait until other people tell these stories, I think that's very problematic. We're seeing a wave of fascism going around the world and colonial power dynamics being repeated in Gaza and other places to the extreme. And people, I think, not just the people who are actually marginalized and oppressed, but also those with privilege who should contribute to fighting against this system. So I hope that this whole conversation about identity politics eventually transforms to something that is really inclusive. Because right now I think it's mostly stuck at a symbolic level. And people are kind of like fighting symptoms, but we rarely talk about the structural problems that are underneath. And also in the film industry, you see like more opportunities for people of color and diversity, equity, inclusion. That's all super important. I'm all for that. But that doesn't solve structural inequality. It still continues. And I want to contribute to a more equal world. So yeah, but I don't know what it means for the future exactly.
Maybe what does it mean for your future? Or how do you see this mission in progress in your future as a maker?
Well, I've felt pretty shitty over the past year because I've felt like my work was discredited partly because I'm like a white man.
Mm.
And something that was made out of an act of solidarity was framed as potentially being problematic because I'm like a white guy and I shouldn't be telling this story. And that's deeply frustrating because it's like, to me, it's an act of love. And it made me question whether I should continue to tell these kinds of stories. Because if I make another film about people who are being oppressed and who are not of my skin color, and if it's going to be another confronting film, does that mean that I invest another several years of my life into a project that people don't want to see or that they regard as somehow inappropriate? But yeah, I mean, I also understand that I cannot allow that to numb me or to discourage me to a point where I don't make the things that I think are important to be made.
I hope it won't. I think your film is for a lot of people who don't have the words to talk about big taboos. I would say especially pedophilia. I hope for many this is their dancer in the dark and that they will get back to it a couple of years from now. And that maybe you have, for some, in the first confrontation with their blind spots.
Mm. That would be great.
I want to really also congratulate you for your bravery. And I think it's you take an example for what a lot of Europeans should be doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Celebrating Cinema. Make sure to watch The Garden of Earthly Delights, which is in Dutch cinemas now. If you haven't had enough, you can go back and listen to our latest episode on iconic director Akira Kurosawa.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. If you love what we do, support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. And don't forget to check the show notes for all the films mentioned, bonus info, and ticket links. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.